Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab. Adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And is America having the wrong gun control debate? You know who thinks we are? New York City Police Commissioner Ray Kelly.
For us in New York City, and I believe in most urban centers throughout America, the problem really is concealable handguns. Only 2% of the people that we've arrested for guns in the last 2 years have had assault weapons. We don't want them on the streets, make no mistake about it. But the problem is the handgun. 60% of the murders in New York City are caused by handguns, and we simply have too many of them.
Police Commissioner Kelly on Face the Nation last weekend. Assault weapons bans, big magazine bans, mostly irrelevant to crime in the city. Universal background checks may be more relevant, but the issue here in New York is illegal handgun trafficking. Let's see what can be done. Back with us for his final weekly visit in our January series is Paul Barrett, Assistant Managing Editor at Bloomberg Businessweek and the author of Glock, The Rise of America's Gun. Hi, Paul, and thanks for this fascinating series all month. We are lucky that January has five Thursdays, so we got one extra visit with you.
Great to be here, and I've enjoyed it. Thanks.
You wrote about Ray Kelly's position on Business Week yesterday, and you went into a few more of the statistics. Of the 2,800 guns seized by the NYPD last year, about 2,800, 90% were handguns. Only 3% were assault rifles. Do you know what percentage were Glocks, by the way, since you wrote that book?
I don't. They didn't break it out that way. But I would be surprised if it was more than a tiny percent. Glocks are relatively high-priced and not often found at crime scenes.
So what are they? Because he did make that point of saying cheap handguns.
Yeah. These are throwaway handguns. They're knockoff handguns, and they're older handguns. Many of them are actually revolvers that were made 20, 30 years ago. And they're the guns that are floating around in the black market and are easily available, sad to say, to criminals in this city and other cities.
Adding to our vocabulary list, which we've been compiling this month for the gun illiterate, which is many of us, why do you distinguish revolver from another kind of handgun? What does revolver actually mean?
Sure. Revolver is a handgun that has the cylinder that revolves as each time you pull the trigger. Has to be loaded with individual rounds in each opening in the cylinder. Usually has five or six rounds, smaller capacity than the semi-automatic pistol such as the Glock, which can have 10, 12, 15, 17 rounds.
And where do these illegal handguns come from? You wrote that certain states with laxer gun laws than New York supply most of the crime guns used here, Virginia, Pennsylvania, Georgia, both Carolinas, Florida, you single all those out. What is it about those state laws that most distinguishes them from New York?
Well, I think it's a combination of the fact that, first of all, guns are sold very widely in those states. I mean, in contrast to New York City, where for all practical purposes, if you're not a cop, you can't just walk into a store and buy a gun. Moreover, you can't legally acquire a gun unless you have a permit from the NYPD, and they don't give them out very readily. In the states you just mentioned, pretty much anyone of the proper age can go to a weekend gun show and possibly even without a background check being performed, buy a gun from someone who's not a federally licensed dealer, or for that matter, buy five guns or 10 guns, hop in a car, drive up to New York, and sell them for three times as much as he bought them for. It's a very good illicit business from a profit point of view.
Listeners, we can take your calls for Paul Barrett today on illegal handgun trafficking. Let's leave the assault weapons ban, the big magazine ban aside for the moment. I do think that the universal background check question is relevant to this conversation, the third big policy debate they're having in Washington. But let's talk about illegal handgun trafficking. Anything you want to say or anything you want to ask, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or post to WNYC.org. click on Brian Lehr Show to post a comment. And while you're there, there's an excellent website that we have linked to called tracetheguns.org, produced by Mayor Bloomberg's group, Mayors Against Illegal Guns. It's an interactive map that allows you to click on each state and see where it ranks on exporting crime guns. And it shows which gun laws designed to prevent crime gun trafficking each state has. For example, Mississippi turns out to be the number one state for the export of guns used in crimes. And Mississippi does not have 9 out of the 10 laws that the site says would help deter trafficking. So no criminal penalties for making a straw gun purchase for someone who couldn't pass a background check in Mississippi. No requirement for background checks at gun shows. It does not require purchase permits for handguns. And you can see the site and go down that list. So find the link on our page at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehr Show. Does Ray Kelly, Paul, talk about what state laws he thinks are most important to stop this illegal gun trafficking to New York?
Well, he is certainly a very strong proponent of background checks being performed for all gun transactions in all states at all times. And I think that would take off the table the basically open trade in guns among people who are selling them and buying them back and forth without anyone even having to ask who's the person buying the gun, who's the person buying these 5 guns, and what are they doing with them. As you've mentioned, I think that's the big first place to start.
It's the universal background checks. And it occurred to me, and we'll play a clip of Wayne LaPierre here in just a second from yesterday's Senate hearing, but if people are going to argue you can't stop the black market and compare it to drugs, it occurred to me that there's a very big difference between illegal gun sales and illegal drug sales. The drugs never start out in the legal commerce system.
Right.
Drugs are illegal everywhere, basically. And then they wind up on the street. Guns, every illegal gun in New York, tell me if I'm overstating this, but I think every illegal gun that's used in a crime in New York City started life as a legally sold gun somewhere.
Yes, that's basically correct. And what you're saying is true. And of course, no particular law is going to eliminate the vast black market in guns in this country. The question is whether you put tools in place and deterrence in place that allow the police to do a better job of keeping guns out of the hands of criminals. And to accomplish that, you need more than laws. You need retail gun stores that are being vigilant and socially responsible. You need to have vigorous police departments, such as the police department in this city, which has done a good job in reducing illegal gun possession on the streets. And we've seen that in our steadily declining homicide rates. It does not come without costs. Many people complain about the techniques the police use, but for better or for worse, they are discouraging people from carrying guns illegally on the streets of New York.
Here is the NRA's Wayne LaPierre opposing universal background checks in yesterday's Senate hearing.
It's only going to hit the law-abiding people, not criminals. Honest people are going to be entrapped into committing crimes they had no intention to commit, and it's an unworkable universal federal nightmare bureaucracy.
But Paul, you wrote yesterday, actually you mentioned in your article on Bloomberg Businessweek, something else that Wayne LaPierre said in the hearing, which is that he acknowledged that he actually used to support universal background checks when he was with the NRA in the 90s.
Right.
So why did he then, and what changed?
Well, I think as recently as 1999, he told Congress that the NRA did not oppose background checks on all gun sales. It's not that they were enthusiastic about it, but they were not going to draw the line there. And I think the reason they didn't oppose that is because the rational, logical position is that background checks do not impede lawful gun owners from acquiring guns. If you are not in one of the prohibited categories, a felon, a fugitive, adjudicated mentally ill, underage, so forth, the background check, it does not interfere. I think the problem was that when Wayne LaPierre took that seemingly reasonable position in 1999, he got a lot of backlash internally within the NRA. He got it in the neck, and the NRA, as a result, is now taking a more absolutist position.
So this is my own editorial opinion, but it seems to me that this is where the staunch gun rights advocates either don't get it or decide to be willfully blind. And that is that to stop or at least slow the flow of crime guns, law-abiding gun owners who should be protected have to take part in common sense tracing systems. So background checks, for example, make every gun traceable, keep a record of each gun like we keep a record of each car. Law-abiding gun owners who Wayne LaPierre is trying to protect won't get in trouble for this, but the NYPD and the FBI will catch more traffickers and prevent more trafficking. Why is it such a sacrifice for law-abiding gun owners to make to help catch the criminal gun owners?
I don't think it is a sacrifice. And I think I would disagree just slightly with your editorial observation in that it's not a question of Wayne LaPierre not getting it or being willfully blind. He knows exactly what he's doing. At this point, his political calculation is we oppose everything the Democrats and the Obama administration are in favor of.
But the people who he speaks to, yes, certainly he's a professional lobbyist. He knows exactly what he's doing. But we could take gun calls all day from gun owners who are going to say, don't take away my freedom with a universal background check or gun registration when you're really trying to catch a bad guy, which I'm not.
Yeah. Well, that would be an illustration of how guns and the regulation of gun ownership is in large part a symbolic issue. I mean, in the end, we cannot come to a complete meeting of the minds on this issue because guns represent something to people apart from their practical impact on society. And as a result of that, I think people of good faith have to acknowledge that we have to come to compromises. And if people take absolutist positions, no compromise will come.
Paul Barrett, author of Glock. David in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello, David.
Precisely the distinction that we should have been making all along and the conversation we should have been having. I think that politically speaking, it's the long guns, the hunting and assault-style weapons that have the primary clamor for particularly the heartland, the NRA. That's what your average American gun owner who believes in the protection of freedom against government tyranny and who believes in hunting and those fundamental values is really attached to and finds so particularly alluring. You know, handguns are an attraction too. But obviously for us in the city, the problem is completely different. It's not one so much of glamour, it's of crime. And the handgun, remember, it is simple to use, it's small, it's light, and it can be easily concealed and, of course, used by a child.
David, thank you for your call. And you know, it harkens back to another word in the Ray Kelly clip that we haven't talked about yet. The beginning of that clip, he said, I believe in most urban centers throughout America. As for us in New York City, the problem really is concealable handguns. So the word concealable.
Well, that's absolutely right. I mean, criminals who are in it to make money are going to use the most efficient tool. And when you're going in to hold up a bodega on a street corner in New York, or you're going to stick up your drug rival to get his cash in his pocket, you're going to want to do it in a way that minimizes your chances of being caught. Waving around a big rifle is certainly going to attract people's attention. You can use a handgun and not be noticed.
We'll continue in a minute. More of your calls. And Paul Barrett, author of Glock, Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, as we ask, is America having the wrong gun control debate, at least for New York and other cities? Ray Kelly, we heard him on Face the Nation, the clip we played earlier saying assault weapons bans, big magazine bans, mostly irrelevant to the crime in the city. And I want to play one more clip, and then we'll go back to some calls as we continue with Paul Barrett, author of Glock, The Rise of America's Gun. Here's a question about the ATF, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, which the NRA also loves to hate. But this came on our show last week from the newly elected congressman from Brooklyn and Queens, Hakeem Jeffries, who noted that there is no discernible presence of the ATF that he's ever been aware of in his district.
The ATF is responsible for enforcement of illegal interstate gun trafficking. And at least in my capacity as a member of the Assembly for the last 6 years, I've seen no evidence that they've been actively involved. Now, if they're not in Harlem, the South Bronx, East New York, or Bedford-Stuyvesant, where are they?
If they're not in Harlem, East New York, Bedford-Stuyvesant, the South Bronx, where are they? If our topic is gun trafficking, Paul, have you ever looked into that? Why isn't the ATF in Harlem, in the Bronx, and East New York?
Yeah. Well, I would imagine that the New York field office of the ATF has run investigations that involve those jurisdictions. They're not as visible as the NYPD. They are always in plain clothes. They work on long-term cases. However, the congressman's point, I think, is very well taken. The ATF is a notoriously beaten down and, sad to say, in many parts of the country, incompetent agency. That was proved by this horrible scandal they got enmeshed in the Southwest, known as Fast and Furious. This is a perfect example of an area where people could easily compromise. You could have more aggressive investigations of gun trafficking, it seems to me, without any danger to the Second Amendment. But instead, we prefer to argue endlessly about assault weapons and what qualifies as an assault weapon.
Retired Police Lieutenant Danny in Massapequa. Hey, Danny, you're on the air.
How you doing? Good morning, guys. Great discussion. I like to think of myself as a conservative with sanity, you know, through respect to Ed Koch. And I agree with you, Brian. And you made a great analogy, and I like to go a little further.
Mm-hmm.
If I own an automobile and you show up at my house one day and you want to buy it, you drive away with my car. I have a record of that sale. And if 7 years later that car was never registered and it ends up on the other side of the country used in a crime, it's coming back to me because I'm the last person who had registered the car. Now, if you want to buy a gun, and have a handgun, okay, you should have to have that registered. And if you want to sell it, you should sell it to someone who is able to buy that handgun. And you accomplish that by somehow getting involved with your local police jurisdiction and having them do the background investigation on the person.
Why do you think law enforcement officials seem somewhat divided about these questions, Danny? There was a story in the news this week about sheriffs, I think, from around the country saying if what they're debating in Washington gets enacted, they're not going to enforce it because it's unconstitutional.
I think, again, they're talking about rifles because the firearm is specifically, the definition for a firearm, it's a rifle shotgun longer than 22 inches, I believe, although it's been a while since I passed the test, so I'm not really sure. Handguns are completely legislated, so you can control handguns. You need a permit. You need a permit to carry a handgun. You do not need a permit to walk down the city of New York with a rifle slung on your shoulder, as long as this shotgun is in a package that you can't see it's a gun and it's unloaded. That's not true with a pistol. It's now, like I said, if I'm in New York City and I want to, and I just drove down to, it sounds crazy that I can drive down to Virginia, buy five pistols legally because I have my permit, I show it to somebody, and then somehow not be held accountable as to where those weapons end up. Now, yes, if I want to sell it and I list it on Craigslist or my local store and somebody shows up with a pistol permit from New York City that's able to buy the gun, I can legally sell them that gun and there's a record of their transaction. How I would ever get rid of that gun to a person who's less than legal, I don't understand how that can take place because you should be held accountable where you have to show what happened to that gun. And if you're not, if you can't, and that gun is used in a crime, they should come back and put handcuffs on you for somehow getting rid of, illegally getting rid of a firearm.
Illegally getting rid of it. Danny, thank you very much. And this brings me back to tracetheguns.org, that website from Mayor Bloomberg's group, Mayors Against Illegal Handguns. And again, they rank the 50 states in terms of their exports of crime guns, Mississippi number one, Virginia, which Danny just mentioned, number six. A lot of the guns that wind up here illegally come from Virginia. From Mississippi, I gather they go largely to Chicago. But when you look at the laws in Mississippi and that Mayors Against Illegal Guns list that they only have one out of the 10 laws that they consider relevant to stopping illegal gun trafficking. Is any of this something that Congress could take up at the national level? So Mississippi, as I said before, allows does not allow criminal penalties for buying a gun for someone who can't.
Yes. Well, for example, that's a good place to start. Congress can pass and the president can sign a federal law. We do not have one right now that makes straw purchasing itself a federal crime that would be enforceable by the ATF. Right now, straw purchasing is generally policed either under state laws in those states that have their own laws or under sort of false statement laws when people lie on forms, and it's a very indirect kind of way of enforcing it. So, yes, there are things that can be done. In the end, though, culture is very important to this. If gun stores in Mississippi and people who own guns in Mississippi are simply going to look away from suspicious transactions and are going to allow people to lie to them, it'll be tough to stop all of the straw purchasing and all of the gun trafficking. A big problem here is there are gun stores, and the criminals know which ones, that are basically receptive to straw purchasing.
Do they buy them in bulk for trafficking to the streets of New York, or do they buy them one by one? Because I imagine there are organized crime syndicates that are buying up as many guns as they can, and then they get sold illegally and distributed to, you know, more street-level dealers in the city. Is that how it works?
To a surprising degree, gun trafficking is done on a relatively small level. You might think that there would be an organized crime group that would buy up hundreds of guns. It's actually most of even the biggest cases the ATF does make involve very small groups of people who might buy 5 guns in this store, 2 guns in that store over a period of a week. They might get together 25 or at the outside 50 guns, put them in the trunk of the car, and up they come to New York. So it's not a very sort of high-level form of organized crime, but it doesn't have to be. It's a very simple activity, and because of lax regulation, it's not something that requires a huge amount of advanced planning.
And on that question of numbers of guns in a purchase, Keith in Caldwell has a question. Hi, Keith.
Hi. So with the universal background checks, it's my understanding that when you get a NICS check when purchasing a gun, it's not sending any information about how many you are going to purchase. And if it is relatively small scale, what's going to be the defining factor for an ATF agent coming and knocking on your door?
Thank you.
Well, I mean, he's correct that the NICS check does not in and of itself identify whether the potential purchaser is buying 1 gun or 2 guns. And I don't think that any NICS check would all by itself would cause the ATF to come knocking at your door. The question is whether the ATF could amalgamate statistics that show that over a period of time, guns recovered at crime scenes all tend to be coming from Joe's gun shop. Yeah. Then they might want to go and visit
Which
Joe.
Which they can or can't now, and we have 10 seconds left.
They have the capacity. They are bullied out of it in political terms.
Well, this has been such a fascinating 5 weeks, and obviously not the last conversation we'll have on this show by any means in the coming weeks about guns. But 5 Thursdays in January with Paul Barrett, Assistant Managing Editor at Bloomberg Businessweek and the author of Glock, The Rise of America's Gun. So informative. Thank you for all your reporting and analysis and spending so much time with us this month. It's been great.
My great pleasure.